Good morning.
My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education lead. Couple housekeeping things first. Paul is going to reference the book, Not in God's Name, and we do have a couple on reserve in the library, so you can take a look at it, borrow it for not very long time, but at least get a grip of what the book is like if you would like to purchase it later on. So that is there. If Paul is mic'd, so we will be able to hear him, but sometimes it's really difficult to hear in here. So if you are asking a question or making a comment, use your playground voice. So Paul, right, Paul?
Right, okay. Thank you.
And he will remind you if you are not using that voice. So thank you. It's my pleasure to introduce Paul Rohde, who has been in the village in some capacity, even as a wait dry, I just heard, from 1993 to 2012, and then have taken an unwanted reprieve. Yeah. Is that a good way
we
to put it?
We missed it a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we missed them, so it's wonderful to have you back in the village.
Thank you.
Paul's going to be leading Living Word at 9 every morning, Monday through Friday. And I think we're going to get to tell some sibling stories, right?
We are.
Yes. Okay, I've got a few of those. And his title is Listening to Genesis for Clues About Loving Our Neighbors and Siblings. So thank you for gracing your presence with the village again, and we're thrilled to have you back, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you. And so you can hear me? Yeah, this is live. I'm absolutely thrilled to be back. Actually, I came to the village the first time in 84. My wife came in 81 for the first time. So we've got a long history with the village. We've lived in the Midwest. So from 93 to 2012, averaging more than a time a year was a real commitment. But we're grateful for all we've learned and all the ways the village has shaped us and are thrilled to be back. I think you heard last night that when I'm not at the village, I'm campus pastor at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. I'll say it again. I'm campus pastor at Augustana University. Go Bites! Here we are. It is so fun to teach here. That doesn't happen anywhere else. And you are going to get to tell stories about your siblings, and I think mostly we will do that with everybody talking at once. So then you probably don't want to do it playground voice. But partly I do that to be protective, because our sessions are taped, you know. And so I want you to know that as you discern what stories you may want to share about your siblings. People all have stories about that, although not everybody has a sibling. And I might as well start right there to say, if you don't have a sibling, worry not. We need your voice in this discussion. I could see you participated in at least a couple of ways. One is to share with us from your vantage point what you see about people who do have siblings. Because those of us who have them interpret all of siblinghood through that lens, right?
Yes.
And so if somebody is here who's got a more objective lens, that would be great. The other thing I think, some of my colleagues at Augie, with whom I discussed preparing this, are only children, and they said they have friends with whom they share a lot of sibling dynamics. And so you can certainly enter in that way. I wanted to start by just raising the question, if you were going to tell the story of the world, what category would you use? I mean, what people would you talk about, write about, describe? Would you tell a story of kings and queens? Would you tell a story of armies or geniuses? Would it be a story of craftspeople? You know, carpenters and engineers and builders? Is this where the power of the world comes from? Maybe you would tell the story of artists. I do not apologize for the fact that I read as much fiction as I do theology. I think fiction is a great way to tell the story of the world. Would it even occur to you to tell the story of the world through the lenses of sisters and brothers? To be perfectly honest, I don't use the family metaphor for church very much. When people say to me the church is a family, I always want to say, whose family? And I honestly think one family is just the right amount for all of us. I would much rather use neighborhood. You know, That's also a very biblical word. We are neighbors, but it's a little more spacious. We've all got neighbors who are different than we, but we are cordial across the fence, right? And the Bible tells a story about siblings, not only in Genesis, but in Exodus. The story of Exodus is largely the story of three siblings, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. They get along a lot better than the siblings in Genesis. Genesis is going to be a juicy kind of tale. So I've got some pictures up here to get us going. The first is a graphic of Isaac and Ishmael that I absolutely love because they are almost indistinguishable. And yet the story, that's the story we're going to do today, and the story will divide them so sharply. So I loved this picture. And the first folks who came into the room already identified this. This dates people, but I figured there'd be a fair number of people here who lived in the 20th century and would know, you want to say it together, these are?
And
Abby Van Buren, right? Dear Anne and Dear Abby, the advice columnists from the last century. I don't know if you know that they are twin sisters. Born and raised in Sioux City, Iowa, of all places. And interesting, as I was doing all this sibling research, I Googled famous sibling rivalries. And they came up right away. They did not get along in life. They were very threatened by one another. And the source I had on the internet, for whatever that's worth, said that the feud is continuing into the next generation. So I put the picture up there because I wanted to prepare you for irony. I hear a lot of irony in the stories we're going to read in Genesis. And don't you find it ironic that the people who advised me, arguably more people than anybody else in the 20th century, about how to get along, couldn't get along themselves. So, and maybe that is why the Bible used siblings. I don't know. One of the interesting factoids I learned about siblings, or interpretations of siblings, somebody said, we need to realize that siblings know us our whole lives. You know, our parents know the beginning of our lives, but they will not know the end. And our spouses know us largely in adulthood. Most of us are adults. Our children will know the end of our lives, but our siblings get the whole. I mean, largely. If it goes okay, we lose siblings along the way too, but they know the whole thing. So then the last picture is to prove to you that I am qualified to lead a discussion on sibling rivalry. This is my brother, Bruce. I hope the shirts we're wearing are not a comment about our relationship. This picture was taken in 1981. Is anybody here from Rochester, Minnesota?
Close. Byron.
Byron, Minnesota. Okay, then you need to hear me say, my brother is a great person. Okay?
Okay.
If you ever meet him, you say, your brother taught at Holden Village, and he said you are a great person, just in case I say some other things.
Okay.
I mean, it's been so fun to lead up to this, because everybody I told what I was going to do had a story about their sibling. So I told my former bishop that this is what I was doing at Holden, and she said, oh, I should send my sister. It would be good for her. So, I mean, one of the other things I can tell you, this really applies more to the Jacob story than it does the Isaac story, but you notice that Bruce is quite a bit larger than I. And this happened early on. We're 2 years apart. I am the older. And he got bigger than me when I was 9, he was 7 or 10. And so then, humiliation of humiliation, we had hand-me-up clothing. I had to wear his clothes after he was through with them. And I couldn't take him on. He was big. So I learned to fight with my tongue. And truth be told, I'm probably still in recovery for that. So just be warned. We're going to do three things each day. Most importantly, we're going to listen to these stories in Genesis. And in my study, Sharon already told you about the book that I'm going to be referencing most often that uncovers things. Next year will be 40 years since I started seminary. I have read the book of Genesis and lived with it for a long time, preached it and loved it, and honestly thought I understood it. And Rabbi Sacks has helped uncover things that I simply never noticed before, and I really look forward to sharing some of those things with you. We'll tell stories, as I said, about our own siblings, and then we're going to discuss implications for interfaith relationships today, particularly between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, because we are all descendants of Abraham. And so the Abrahamic faiths, and because we have such a sharp history of conflict. And I'll say more about what Rabbi Sacks says about that in a minute. First of all, just a couple of things I want to tell you about me as a teacher, all right, or as a theologian. One thing, things come out when you write. You know, I was filling out mobility papers one time for our Senate office, and I found myself writing that if it were only theology I loved, I'd have become a professor. And if it were only people I loved, I'd have become a chaplain. But I really love the intersection of theology and people. And therefore, I am a pastor. And I have loved being a pastor. To be exploring always the intersection of texts and our lives. So this will not be the most academic discussion of the book of Genesis you've ever had, nor will it be the most psychological discussion of siblings you've ever had. This is hopefully going to be probing an intersection. The other thing that I think has kept me really happy about being a pastor is that pastors are among the last generalists left. In any given day, I am a teacher, I'm a counselor, I'm an administrator, I'm a business manager, I'm a musician, I'm a friend, a writer, I have loved dabbling in all things, and it's great to work on a campus because I get to learn from all the disciplines. I'm soaking this up all the time. So through the years, I've dabbled in family systems and birth order and genograms, and I know there are other things I was going to say about that. And I probably know enough about any of them just to be dangerous. But the thing I know about Holden is that there are probably people in the room who have more expertise in all these areas than I do. And I really hope this will be a discussion, that you will feel free to share what you know or to challenge what I may assert. No pride of authorship here. Let's go at it. And I think we'll all learn really well together. There is a sequence, I should have said this about the Genesis, a sequence of five sibling rivalries. We're going to take them a little out of order. We're going to start with Isaac and Ishmael, as I told you, because I think it will help you hear where we're going with the whole series. And then we're going to go back to Cain and Abel tomorrow. And then we will go forward to Jacob and Esau. And then we will do Rachel and Leah. And we will end on Friday with Joseph and his siblings. That's the only one that's not a pair. Jacob was prolific, and so there's a whole mob of siblings there. So, for starters, let's get started. Each day, I'm going to put up a verse that I think is significant, that may be astonishing. This is a verse that I think is largely neglected in the story of Genesis. It's from 25, verse 9. Abraham dies, and the Bible records very starkly his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried Abraham in the grave at Machpelah. Machpelah means double blessing. Maybe some of you already know why that's remarkable. I don't expect you to know that. But I thought it might be fun to start with an easier question. When have you and your siblings stood side by side? I mean, we have this picture of Abraham and Isaac, Isaac and Ishmael, burying their father together as brothers. And there are many parts of the story where we would not assume that it would end this way. But this is where the story goes. So we're cheating a little, going to the end. But just turn to the people next to you and think about when is a time that you and your siblings have stood side by side or have cooperated or been together on something. And if there is a reason that's remarkable, why is that remarkable? What made it remarkable? So, go ahead. Take a minute or two. Good morning. Good morning. Hello. I'm going to use my playground voice, even though I have a microphone. Okay, thank you. Thank you for participating. Well, a couple, anybody want to share what kinds of stories we have? Go ahead.
My wife and I both spoke about being with our siblings at the death of our parents. Yeah. I think that's probably a common story.
Yeah. That's my story too. And but not to be assumed. And therefore, a real gift. That's wonderful. Any others? Go ahead.
We stood together, but I stood with my brother when he came out as a gay person.
Okay.
So that was a really. We were always 5 years apart. I was on to the next thing when he was still, you know, 5 years behind me, and we weren't real close growing up. But when that happened, I mean, we got close as adults. But when that happened, it was really a solidifying. Stand together moment.
Mm-hmm. Any others? One more? Go ahead.
This is lighthearted.
Good.
My brother has one sibling. He's younger. And so the one that feels was shorter. So I began to realize this was changing. So I would not stand next to him lest he realize that I was higher than him. There was a point which you could not deny. He's now 6'3". I'm still 5'6".
I feel your pain. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I did want to just say a word about Jonathan Sacks. He was the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom from 1991 to 2013. I got to hear him at the 9/11 Museum in New York City in spring of 2016 when I was out there with a group of students. I told you a little about our work in New York City last night. And he is such a wise and insightful and winsome teacher. There are tons of videos of him. He has recently won the Templeton Prize for Global Impact. And the day I heard him was the day of the terrorist attack in Brussels. So the news was sort of one more, you know, religiously motivated thing. His book is called Not in God's Name. And the subtitle is Confronting Religious Violence. And I met the book early in 16 and read it through the summer and loved it. When I got the invitation to come and teach, knew that it's one of the things I would really like to share with you and thought it would work very well here. But as 2016 went on, I don't need to rehearse the history of 2016 with you, the topic just seemed to get more and more urgent. As everything we read about our world is polarization and difference and divisiveness and it erupts in violence in so many ways. This was an optional thing for my students. You know, we have a covenant going into a trip and they agreed that they're going to do all the service things, but the evenings are free and they are in New York City, so you can imagine that there are lots of things they want to do. But about half a dozen students went with me to hear Rabbi Sacks. And every one of them bought his book, which I thought was really indicative of the power of what he has to say. He's going to bring some really precise vocabulary. Every day we'll learn some new vocabulary around the way he sorts out the sources of violent impulses, and here's the Bible's response to them. But this is just a little bit to whet your appetite. The very texts that lie at the root of the problem, we will hear that. Is the minute we read the text this morning, we're ready to hear that. If properly interpreted, can provide a solution. This, though, will require a radical rereading of those texts through an act of deep listening to the pristine voice of monotheism itself. Tomorrow we'll take on monotheism versus dualism. And with Cain and Abel, and that will be very significant. Faith is God's call to see his trace in the face of the other. But this needs a theology of the other, which I offer in this book. So what do we believe about the other? Who do we see in the face of the other? I talked to another pastor at breakfast this morning who said after Trump was elected, every sermon to her felt political. Love your neighbor felt like this radical, political kind of statement. So I do think it's crucial and helpful for us to explore a theology of other. One of the things that really won me over with Rabbi Sacks right away was he said that he wanted to write a book that was critical of Islam, but he knew that would have no integrity till he'd written a book that was critical of Judaism. And I think that will help us think critically and carefully about our own assertions about ourselves as Christians. What have we said, and what is assumed about us as Christians, and why? And what does monotheism call us to? What does Jesus reveal to us? Will, I think, be very significant. So I'm looking forward to it, and it's time to get started. Let's go to Genesis 21. And I have up here, we'll read 8 to 21, but we don't get to read that many happy verses. So why don't we start with verse 1 of chapter 21. Today we're going to deal with these texts in parallel. So Genesis 22 is the story of the call of Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. And a lot of times that text gets pulled out of context, read all by itself. But today we're going to start with 21, and the way Sacks sets this up is to hear first of all the sacrifice of Ishmael, and then to hear the sacrifice of Isaac, and to think about how the stories are told. We're not going to have time every day to read the whole story, and today, but I don't want to make any assumptions about this. So, in the book of Genesis, we meet Abraham and Sarah in chapter 15, where Abraham is given this covenant of God, the Abrahamic covenant, that God promises to give him a land, to give him descendants, many descendants, to make of him a great name, and to bless him so that he will be a blessing to others. This is the vocation of Abraham, and really, I think, of the Abrahamic religions, to be a blessing to others. And there is this one minor little stumbling block, and that is that Abraham and Sarah are ancient, and they have no children. And I don't mean just that they lived a long time, I mean they're very old people. They're in their 80s and 90s. People joke about, you know, the reaction in the Social Security office when these bills came through, that they were now in prenatal care. And it doesn't come. I mean, they've had infertility, and they have infertility. And so Sarah suggests that Hagar, her maid, go into Abraham, and then Abraham and Hagar conceive and give birth to Ishmael. And then we're going to pick the story up now when Isaac is born, who is Abraham and Sarah's son. I loved teaching confirmation as a parish pastor. And I vowed, the thing I loved about it was discovering that the best way for confirmation not to be boring was to have them read the Bible. So I had him read all the salty passages too. I will never forget the day this kid came in. He threw his Bible on the table and he said, that's the day we had read the Hagar story. You know, he said, I can't believe what's in this book. I thought the Bible was boring. I said, what made you think the Bible was boring? He said, well, just look at the cover. Don't judge a book by its cover. So I'll read a ways, and then I may ask you to pick up. The Lord dealt with Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised. Sarah conceived and bore Abram a son in his old age, at the time of which God had spoken to him. Abram gave the name Isaac to his son whom Sarah bore him. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Now Sarah said, God has brought laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And she said, who would have ever said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I've borne him a son in his old age. The child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, playing with her son Isaac. So she said to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not inherit along with my son Isaac. The matter was very distressing to Abraham on account of his son. But God said to Abram, do not be distressed because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you. For it is through Isaac that offspring shall be named for you. As for the son of the slave woman, I will make a nation of him also, because he is your offspring. So Abram rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away, and she departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water in the skin was gone, she cast the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bowshot, for she said, do not let me look on the death of the child. And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Do not be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Come, lift up the boy and hold him fast with your hand, for I will make a great nation of him. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. She went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother got a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Okay, there are a whole bunch of interpretive things I could say, but let's just kind of sit with that passage a minute, the sacrifice of Ishmael. Right? Now let's go to Genesis 22 and hear this. And as you hear it, keep that 21 story rattling in your mind, and we're going to do a little comparison. How are these stories told, and what do you feel, and how do you react between the two? So starting with 22, verse 1. After these things, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you. So Abram rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. On the third day, Abram looked up and saw the place far away. Then Abram said to the young men, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, and he carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac said to his father, Abraham, father, and he said, here I am, my son. He said, the fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God himself will provide the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. When they came to the place that God had shown him, Abram built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abram reached out his hand and took the knife to kill his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abram, Abram. And he said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abram looked up and saw a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Abram went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abram called that place, the Lord will provide, as it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. So, you get to start. What do you notice about these two passages and the way they're told? Any reactions? Go ahead.
Twice, and I don't know why it hasn't hit me before. Twice he says, your son, your only son. This is not his only son.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. Good observation. Very good start. Other reactions? Go ahead, back here.
God tells him to obey his wife's idea of casting out the other one in one story, but in the other story, he speaks directly to Abram.
Okay. Let's play with that a little bit. What else do you notice about God telling Abram to heed his wife's reaction?
Well,
What does the text say? Notice verse 11. I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
That Ishmael is going to have a nation as well. So
Ishmael is going to have a nation as well, exactly. But do you know, what does it say in verse 11?
The matter was very distressing to Abraham.
The matter was very distressing to Abraham on account of his son. Understandable, right? Does it say that in chapter 22? No. Abraham has no emotional reaction at all. It just said Abram went and, you know, did what God told him. Where does your greatest empathy or sympathy or passion get stirred by these stories?
Well, I was in the story with Abraham and Isaac. God responds to Abraham, tells Abraham what to do.
Right.
In the story with Hagar, it says God heard the cry of her son. She was weeping. God didn't respond to her pain directly, it was to her son. So I actually feel great sympathy for her right now.
I think you're not alone. Any other reactions? Any other comparisons? You're catching that the story of Hagar is told with such intense emotion and detail. And Sachs will say that the story of Isaac is told devoid of emotion. I don't entirely agree with that. I think the moment that Isaac said to him, "Dad, where's the lamb?" I would have had some feelings at that moment. But even so, it doesn't say that Abraham had feelings. It doesn't say that Abraham went behind a tree and wept. I mean, if I honestly were even contemplating such a thing, but it does say all of that about the Hagar story and the Ishmael story. See, I think the thing that makes this remarkable is that Isaac is clearly the chosen son. The attention is on Isaac. He hears, you meant said it about Ishmael, but the attention here is on the chosenness of Isaac. I mean, I think one of the first things we can learn from this story is to tell our sibling stories with compassion and understanding. I think it's very remarkable that this is the story of Isaac and their descendants, but the story of Ishmael is told with great detail and great understanding and not a little compassion.
Ishmael was the firstborn. There's no escaping.
That's right.
And I was a firstborn, and I was a first girl, and so I was the golden one.
Yeah.
And that's no fun either.
Yeah. I hear you. I'm a firstborn. How many people are firstborns in the room? I said, oh my goodness. Firstborns go to sessions, right? I mean, that's exactly right. You know, but it isn't a picnic. One of the lines in my family is that nothing has ever happened to me. Nothing disappointing. You know, that's sort of the narrative that gets told. I have not faced some of the tragedy that my brother has faced. This is true. But I have had a real life. You know, and we're going to talk about this all week because we're going to have this tension, birth order tension, the whole way. And one of the other things that's really interesting about sibling rivalry is that it exists in nature. Animals have sibling issues. So if you've heard the phrase pecking order, that comes literally from the first chick to hatch being a little bigger and pecking at the other chicks till the first chick has eaten. And hence you have a pecking order. And biologists who have studied this notice that it gets so powerful that the firstborn chick only needs to tip its head and the others back off. And the chick gets the food. But it's not going to be so in the Bible. There are going to be these reversals. I mean, Isaac is going to be the inheritor of the covenant of Abraham. But the thing that we want to notice and remember, the thing I was going to say about Rabbi Sachs being critical of Judaism, that this will be a very different interfaith kind of discussion. I mean, typically, interfaith would start with the Quran or start with the Bhagavad Gita, and then see how we as Christians may connect with another faith. We're going to start with our own documents and see what our own sacred text has to say about how we relate to others. The first thing to note, Sacks will say, is the extraordinary length to which the text goes to insist that Ishmael will be blessed by God. It's stated 4 times in the text. And so the term that we're going to garner from this is counter-narrative. So the narrative is that Isaac is chosen, but the counter-narrative is that Ishmael is not unchosen. And this becomes very, Thursday we're going to look at what the New Testament has done with Judaism and a Christian understanding of Judaism. But this plays out in interfaith relationships because the word is supersessionism. Christians wanting to claim that we now supersede Judaism as the chosen people of God, though we are younger. Yeah, I mean, the New Testament argues about that, and that will be fun to look at those texts. But this is just really important because you think about the birth order. Christianity is younger than Judaism, but claim to supersede then this blessing. I think one of the things that's happened in the book of Genesis is that we hear that Isaac is chosen. We're eager to claim chosenness and blessing, and even though it says so clearly, blessed to be a blessing, we just read into it what we assume chosenness means, rather than really paying attention to the detail of the text about what it does not mean. It does not mean that Ishmael, well, Sarah tries to cast him out, but Ishmael is not cast out of the sight of God. And Islam is going to claim to be descendants of Ishmael. And already the ethnicity in the story is very significant. So when it talks about Sarah afflicting, some translations will use the word afflicting, Hagar. It's the same word that Exodus is going to use for the Egyptians afflicting Israel when the Israelites are slaves in Egypt. And it should not escape our notice that Hagar is an Egyptian woman. So there's this huge tension. The central act of the Hebrew Bible is between Israel and Egypt, and the deliverance from Egypt is huge. But already there's relationship with Egypt here. And then Hagar finds Ishmael a wife from among the Egyptians. And the thing to learn, I mean, or already to start learning, is that the other doesn't go away. And their otherness doesn't go away, right? So I don't think we're going to take time right now to read all 4 of these. Take my word for it or consult Rabbi Sacks' book. 4 times it's promised that Ishmael is blessed. And the interesting thing is then to think about how to be a blessed person among other blessed people. What does that look like? What does that, and is that in fact what the scripture is calling us to? So here's some first we'll read Sacks, okay? In each narrative of parent choice and rejection, there's a counter narrative that subverts the surface story and presents a more nuanced, generous picture of divine and by implication, human sympathy. It's never blatant, okay? It doesn't stand up and say, I am Ishmael and I am the foil, you know, the counter, but it's there. Never unequivocally announces itself, but it's unmistakably there in the text. The counter-narrative is not an interpretation imposed by a modern or postmodern sensibility. The nuances preclude any clear, black and white, good versus bad reading of the text. When we pay attention to this, there's really no way we can say Isaac is good and Ishmael's bad. We certainly cannot say that Sarah is good and Hagar is bad, right? The reads to think about a sermon I heard recently. The service narrative is itself revolutionary. It asserts that the hierarchy of the ancient world, where the elder is destined to rule, the younger to serve, was about to be overthrown. The counter-narrative is more radical still because it hints at the most radical of monotheism's truths, that God may choose, but God does not reject. Tomorrow we're going to go back to Cain and Abel, and we're going to think about the sources of rivalry, and that will cause us to think about dualism, about good versus bad, and about violent impulses and where violence comes from. Brothers can live in peace, so the counter-narrative implies. But if this is true of Isaac and Ishmael, can it really be true of the supreme instance of displacement, the story of Jacob and Esau? You're going to have to wait till Wednesday for that one, and we'll see if that's true. What if the Hebrew Bible understood, as did Freud and Girard, as did Greek and Roman myth, that sibling rivalry is the most primal form of violence? And what if, rather than endorsing it, it set out to undermine it, subvert it, challenge it, and eventually replace it with quite another, quite different way of understanding our relationship with God and the human other? What if Genesis is a more profound, multi-leveled, transformative text than we have taken it to be? What if it turned out to be God's way of saying to us what he said to Cain? That violence in a sacred cause is not holy, but an act of desecration. What if God were saying, not in my name? I mean, this is the crux of what we want to explore. How it is that Genesis may be transforming these impulses to be violent. And my own sense is that this has helped me hear the Bible differently when I think about the times. So my brother and I stood together at my father's death. My father was killed in an accident in 2004. It was very sudden. We had no preparation, no goodbye, anything like that. And what made it remarkable is that Bruce and I had had an enormous fight the day before. And then there we were. But we stood side by side. And he's an engineer and I'm a pastor. So my mom had a great breadth of skill sets, right, for moving on. And I'm really very grateful that we stood side by side. And I think it's very important in the book of Genesis that we notice that Ishmael does not go away in the text. And that when Abram dies, there are Isaac and Ishmael together. Because I think that's not the vision we've had of how this is going to work. Some of the questions I thought we might talk about is, what do we hear so far as the Bible's aim for religion? Is it for one religion to dominate, or is it for them to stand side by side? What do you see, and what have you felt, and what do you hope for? I already said this, one piece of learning is to tell the story of the other sympathetically. If you've had a chance to visit, for example, a concentration camp in Germany, from the Nazi era, I think it takes us miles to telling the story of Judaism in the modern world sympathetically. Now, I don't know how one could walk out of Auschwitz or Dachau and not feel tremendous sympathy and not be ready to think very critically about what it means to be Christian alongside at least our cousins, the Jews, and Sachs is going to argue our siblings, the Jews. I've always been inclined to tell the story of cousins. And I honestly find it easier to get along with cousins than I do siblings. But take a look at these questions and think about what you said about your siblings and what does it cause you to think about? I mean, what might this look like? Come back. Now we've only got a few minutes, but I do hope for some discussion. And I've got one more little story to go. Do you have something?
I had gender thoughts when I heard this. Like when you were asking about I'm getting lost on the names, but Ishmael's mother Hagar was described as emotional, and Abraham wasn't. I see gender issues there,
yeah,
of men subverting their emotion. I'm sure that Abraham was feeling emotion.
I'm sure he was.
And it just wasn't discussed. And and then also why Sarah, it was Sarah's idea for Hagar to go to Abraham, and then when she, but then she had a change of face when she became pregnant or had her own child. Then she did a 180.
Yeah.
So the gender stuff came up as well.
There is a lot of that. And I think especially between Sarah and Hagar, but a woman is much more qualified to speak about that than I am. I think the thing about emotion, where I don't hear Sack's observation here being about gender, is that the emotion of Abraham is recorded in the Ishmael story. And it's not mentioned in the Isaac story. And that, you see, so it's a comparison of a man to a man there. That it says out loud, this was very distressing. And he doesn't say that in chapter 22, which is a really interesting thing to notice.
Do we read into omissions?
Well, I think we can compare. I mean, maybe we're interpreting the omission.
Distressing because it came from his wife.
Yeah.
In conflict with God, you know, who am I gonna listen to here?
Yeah.
Whereas with Isaac, he's listening to the voice of God, and that's his path, straight and narrow.
I'm always curious about what it means to listen to God. You know, how does the voice of God come through? The Bible describes this so directly. I have never experienced that myself. Times that it seemed that things were really clear, I alluded to this last night, most often turned out not to be so. But, go ahead, there's somebody back here.
I was just going to say, I think it's very notable, too, that in the binding of Isaac, Sarah is completely absent from that story.
And the
very next thing after that is that she dies. I mean, that after all of this being about Isaac having to be Sarah's child, it's kind of stunning how there's just no mention whatsoever of any part of for Sarah in that narrative.
I mean, it's a little like step families. And you imagine when a step family is telling its story, and they talk about all this stuff about the step-grandmother and say nothing about their own grandma. You know, because this is Israel telling this story, and Sarah is Israel's grandma. Hagar is not. But there's really a very compelling story told about Hagar. And I do think there is much for us to learn. We're new with interfaith involvement at Augustana, but we're at a place now where approaching 10% of our students are of faith other than Christian. And it's just a ripe environment to learn from one another. And so, for example, we have this Better Together ministry. It's a term used by the Interfaith Youth Corps in Chicago, where we've trained to work on constructive interfaith involvement. And I had two Ethiopian Christians who are students at the school, absolutely thrilled to participate in that because they are surrounded by Muslims in Ethiopia, but they are forbidden to talk to them. So they can learn nothing about Islam. And then had a chance now to talk as Christians and Muslims. We went to the Interfaith Youth Corps training. They did a spontaneous workshop session where every hour a bell would ring, and you could sit at a table where a topic was announced and make up a workshop and talk about what you wanted to talk about. They did this 3 hours, and there were 24 tables with 24 different topics around the room. One table was dialogue between Judaism and Islam, which is Israel and the Arab states, right? It started out, there were only Jews at the table, so they found some other Muslims to come. The students who sat at that table talked all 3 hours. They had never talked. It was remarkable. So the story that I wanted to tell you is that after the refugee executive order, President Trump issued the immigration executive order, in January, Pastor Lene, one of our colleagues in town, this is she, in Sioux Falls, proposed that we have an interfaith prayer service for refugees and immigrants around the world. And it started with the imam chanting. So here we are in the Augustana Chapel. I mean, you can see the reredos behind with the crucifixion and everything. And here is our crew, the rabbi and the imam, and this is the Latina pastor in town. Our Muslim student spoke. This is my colleague, Anna Rosendale, the other campus pastor at Augustana. This is another Muslim who offered reflections. And we sang, this originated at Holden, the Litany of the Nations. Do you know that? Do you sing that up here once in a while? Mm-hmm. Marty Haugen and Susan Brill put that together. We sang the Litany of the Nations. That was one of our contributions. It was amazing to me how natural it felt. It did not feel radical, though it obviously cannot be assumed in the world. But I offered as a picture of a beginning, of a way to get of a way to imagine side by side siblings. That sort of looks like a family picture, doesn't it? And it's obviously very diverse, and we're only beginning. But the thing that happens, the thing that I really want to bear witness to, the thing that happens invariably is that everyone goes into the discussion feeling like they learn more about their own faith. So I have yet to encounter a student who comes out of these discussions feeling less Christian. They come out feeling like they know more and are challenged to probe more about what it means to be Christian, which is in fact what we're doing this week, right? Going to our own text, say, what does our own text say about the other? Who at this moment was Ishmael. But it gets tighter. You know, we're not going to have half-brothers anymore. We're going to have full-blown siblings, and the stories get more colorful and more wild. Did I see some hands? Good.
We just had invited a Muslim into our congregation for a teaching time, and one of the things that he said that I never heard, that I think this is correct me if I'm wrong, if you know, but in the Quran, it's Ishmael that Abraham takes up the hill to sacrifice. So they tell the story, they all tell the story from their own faith perspective.
Right.
And that would be the Fiedler's book on Abraham.
Yeah.
Just talks about, when you go to the Middle East, everyone has an Abraham story, but they're all different and all told from their own perspective.
Right. I have not heard that. So I
will double check on that.
I can disagree with that, but I have not.
That's true.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay, good to know.
This is kind of going back to the Sarah and Hagar thing. What do you think it says that Sarah, it seems to be motivated after Isaac is born by jealousy and greed to cast out Hagar and Ishmael. And Hagar is portrayed as we would expect a mother. You know, a very nurturing mother, loving. And I guess, maybe being jealous and greedy for your son could be a natural response also. But that just occurred to me.
I think that's a very good question. And I can't resolve that. I think we have to live with that tension for the way it's presented in the text. It's just there. And the way you describe it is absolutely accurate and unmistakable. Though I do think jealousy and fear and all these strong emotions, I will speak as a father, are very much a part of parenting. I was totally unprepared for how I would feel about a child who was my own. The joke we tell, we lived in a small town, there's no hospital there, so we drove to take our prenatal classes. The woman who taught us was British, hilarious, had this great accent. Go to, signs of labor, go to the hospital straight away. She would say, straight away. So the night she's giving us the tour of the hospital, we're standing by the nursery, and she said, when your baby is in that nursery, you're going to say that is the most beautiful baby in the whole wide world. And the way home that night, we're driving, I said to Sue, I said, I expect to love our baby. But, you know, I have one beautiful cousin, she's adopted. The rest of us have made peace with what we got. You know, I held Sarah for the second time and I was like, I didn't expect such a beautiful baby. And I mean, this is something we need to think very critically about in terms of family-wise, because helicopter parenting is such a thing. Talk about jealousy and fear and protectiveness. And I heard of a lecture, I didn't hear the lecture, of a journalist who said that her perception is that helicopter parenting is being replaced by fighter jet parenting. Like, it will be time to retire from university work. When, you know, what, how dare you make my baby feel bad? I do think it's a very real part of parenting. And that, in that respect, I feel empathy with Sarah, who is going to be protective. I will not defend her actions, but.
This is the second time, because earlier on, just when Ishmael's born, doesn't Sarah try to get rid of Hagar?
I don't remember. Let's look back, that may be there.
I thought it was like two chapters earlier.
I will check that, and I'll tell you about that tomorrow.
Okay. So
there are two tellings of the story, you're right about that.
In one of your statements that you had up there, and I can't totally remember, but it was about siblings and the other, and, you know, if you think of your sibling being the other, which I never really thought of that much, you're also, I happen to be a therapist, so, you know, you also think about your parents and what parts of your parents and your parents' behaviors and how they've affected your siblings, and I am not a firstborn, I'm the third of 10. So I got to help raise the little ones, and just above me was my sister that I could never be as good as, because she took me until I was an adult to realize that she could do things better than I could because she was a year older than I was, you know. So, you know, lots of comparisons that way also. But I think, you know, it's, you can't think about your siblings, I don't think, without thinking about your parents
right, as
well.
And, I mean, one of the things I suspect, we'll get into this a lot more tomorrow, is that beneath sibling rivalry is this fear of scarcity that's competing for the parents' attention, you know? And time and attention is limited for a parent. Parents are human. And it gets dispersed the way it gets dispersed, and it gets perceived the way it gets perceived, and you don't have a lot of control over it, all of that. But the thing that happens, of course, is that we perceive God as parent. Most often our images of God are parental. And so one of the things that if we discover that that's contributing to sibling rivalry, we want to challenge is whether God is functioning from scarcity. So God only has enough blessing sort of for one of the kids or one of the tribes. And is that a valid biblical presentation of God? I think is something we really want to think about. Okay? Well, we've made a start. Tomorrow we'll read Cain and Abel. That's Genesis 4. So if you want to take a peek at that before we come, and I will check out that other story about Hagar.
16.
Okay, yeah, good. I want to honor time. Thanks for the day.